session number 16850, Reel 8.
Mr. Gibson, Reel 8.
Well, once the fires had been lit, and they'd burned for about an hour and a half, they were allowed to the embers just to stay as ash embers in the fireplace at the bottom end of the hut. The resultant heat had gone on right on through, heated up all the floor underneath the hut, and that would last until the following morning. There would be such at night in midwinter was not a thing you contemplated lightly, especially by that time that we'd been issued with the winter gear, our winter uniforms. And our winter uniforms were blue, again, blue padded cotton trousers, padded cotton jacket, and a powdered ear flap hat with earmuffs that came down the side. And this was all blue, along with padded boots that you put on once you put your uniform, but you very seldom ever came out of your uniform in the winter. You practically slept in it. It was more comfortable to sleep in a padded pair of trousers and jacket on a hard floor than it was using a blue uniform, because you didn't have any padding or mattresses, and your hip bones usually were a horrible colour, where you constantly laid on hip bones that protruded through your skin. So you would have like a very dark bruised area on hips where you lay on your side, and your hip bone dug into the ground because there was no flesh, not a lot of flesh there to absorb the pressure. But these padded jackets were wonderful things. We put them on, we all looked like big teddy bears. And we thought it was great at first, but I think the Chinese knew what was coming in as regards the Siberian winds and the ice and the snow. The snow, when it fell constantly for days on end, and drifts of up to 8, 9, 10 feet. It wasn't uncommon. And the hills, well, they were literally impassable. We never went out into the hills in the winter. Well, no work details, but just moving around the camp itself, that was something in itself. It was still 5 or 6 feet of snow on any level ground. The river had frozen solid, and we were all amazed when we went and walked on the ice of the river to see fish, little fish actually embedded in the ice. You could see little tiny fish embedded in the ice. Apparently they survive in that ice, and they stay in suspended animation, and they're gone the next spring when the melt starts. But I remember it got so bad for water, our water supply, because that was our water supply was the river, the supply for the whole camp and village actually was the river. And the Chinese showed us how to cut big squares in the ice with steps going down, until eventually you ended up at a 2-foot by 2-foot hole at the bottom on the riverbed, and there was water trickling along through the pebbles on the riverbed, and you scooped your water out of that. And every day you went down there, broke the surface ice, and scooped up more water. But you had to make these holes in such a way that you could get up and down. They were about 5 feet deep. 4 to 5 feet deep at least. So we started off with quite a big square hole, and it went down in a step and opened it up another foot less all the way around, and then a foot less all the way around, until eventually you hit the riverbed. And if you had a 2-foot by 2-foot hole at the base, you had the bottom trickle water that came along underneath the river itself, underneath the ice. But any waterfalls were just like suspended crystal palaces. They were literally frozen as they fell. That's the extent of the cold. I think people who'd experienced winter in the front line in Korea in early 50s would remember that, and I think they found that it was a horrific coldness, a horrific, and that was south, down south, and here we were right up north, and the cold. How the armies ever managed to make headway along the length of Korea down to the 38th parallel, you know, beats me. Even how the Chinese managed it, they did, but and through all that snow. And not all ice. We survived in the POW camp, A, because, yes, they did give us the padded jackets. I think they realised that if without them we would have died. We would probably have died. We weren't used to that sort of weather. We'd never been prepared for it. But we did. And not only that, they surprised all of us because I think in their own way they wanted to look after us. But I think, and this is only my own personal opinion, they wanted to feed us and they wanted to clothe us. Now, whether it was because they knew at some stage we were a valuable asset in exchanges of prisoners, and that was going to eventually happen, and they couldn't afford us to have a disease or die or succumb because of the cold and the failure to clothe us and keep us warm. That's probably politically motivated part of it. But I think they were prevented from a lot of it from doing it because the constant air raids that went on, the constant air battles that went on over our heads. And a great sport was to stand out and look up at the sky and watch the American Sabre jets and fighting Russian MiGs. At about 36,000 feet, they were just vapor trails and tiny little silver dots. But you knew when they were fighting because you would hear the brrrr of the 9 millimeter machine guns or whatever it is, 90 millimeters. And you could actually see in the contrails, you could see the little puffs of cannon fire, smoke, little balls like where you know one has fired at another. But this used to go on manoeuvring for hours on end. Well, it appeared to be hours on end, but actually it was probably only minutes. But we really enjoyed it. And the Chinese didn't like it one bit. They hated us to cheer because we used to cheer every time we saw a plane go down. We didn't know whether it was an American plane or a MiG. But we always used to cheer. And the guards used to lose their temper and shout at us, you know. They didn't like to see it. And one incident that really stuck in my mind, there's a couple of instances on air raids that stuck in my mind, because at that time, the early part, the POW camps were not marked as such. They were not marked that this is a concentration of POWs. So to the Americans, it looked like a concentration of troops moving around in a village. Probably from the air. I don't know. I never. The Americans did say they knew where the POW camps were, even though the Chinese hadn't marked them under the agreement at Kaesong. But I can't understand then why did they machine gun us? You know, why was it by accident? Why did one of these big fortresses fly over at night and drop bombs and all the way up the roadway? And of course, there was POWs on each side of the roadway. Some died in the bombing. It's probably one of these friendly fire things again, you know. And we accepted it. We didn't feel any animosity that it had happened. Just terror while it happened. I remember the first time it happened. I think the second year, and it was in summertime again, but it was late at night. And I remember going out of my hut, creeping through the huts to the kitchen hut, where the main kitchen hut was, because that was the only place you could get glowing embers out of the kitchen fire. Our fires, of course, because it's summer, weren't lit, but you could go. And if you had the tobacco that was issued by the Chinese, tobacco leaf, rough leaf, or actually later on it became real tobacco, sliced up loose tobacco, and paper, which we could roll up a smoke. And the only place you could get it lit at night, because you had no matches, was the cookhouse embers. So I went out, oh, about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, maybe even 1 o'clock in the morning, because I didn't have a watch, I didn't know. I have to guess the time. And I remember sneaking away, because you had to be a bit careful, because every so often the guards would patrol through the camp itself, like strolling through with their Tommy guns, just keeping an eye on things. And you had to sort of go from shadow to shadow to shadow till you got to where the cookhouse was, and then dive into the cookhouse pit, because again it was a mud pit with the big cooking pots in it, and get down on your hands and knees and blow like heck on the ashes, see if you could get a glow come up from the ashes of the previous that evening's meal where they'd cooked the rice. You could always get a glow of some description and get a light, and I just lit the thing with a piece of ember, lit this rolled up cigarette with a piece of ember, and I heard the roar of a plane engine, huge, massive sound. And I thought, well, it's a plane, and he's low. I mean, I thought, because we're surrounded by mountains, so, I mean, he must be in the valley. He must have come over and then dropped down into the valley. To get that low and make that amount of noise, and it sounded like he had at least four to six engines, anyhow. Huge sounded the roar of it. And I ran to the front of the hut and looked up at pitch dark, like just, you could just see stars, right? No lights, there's no lights in the village at all. It was all in darkness. And I seen this huge shape of a huge Liberator type of plane go over my head. And I could see the stars on the wing. I could see the American emblem on the thing. And I could see a tail mist gunner firing like hell down into the village, coming from the tail gun. Now, could it have been the tail gun or the bell, but I remembered it was the tail gun. And he was just shattering everything along the road, along the sort of dirt road that ran through the camp. There was like telephone poles every so often, just roughly put up, strung with wires, I expect for communications for the Chinese or the village. And the bullets were literally pulverizing these poles. I watched them just disintegrate. The poles disintegrate. And he strafed all the way up the road, and then I watched him against silhouetted against the stars, and he pulled up, and his engines roared to get him up over the further up the mountain, because again he would have been faced with a climb to get out of the valley. And the Chinese guards were gone berserk. They went absolutely berserk all the way from one end to the other. They were all out firing their Tommy guns up in the air, their Burke guns firing at this huge plane. You could just a big dark shadow of a plane. And they were firing their Tommy guns, Burke guns, because they didn't have any heavy stuff. It was just their own personal weapons, rifles, Burke guns, and Tommy guns, Russian style. And they were firing and firing. You could hear them shout what I always called the airplane sound from the long march up, Sadollah. It was like silver dollar. It sounds like silver dollar. Now, whether it's Chinese for airplane or air attack or air alarm or whatever, but you often heard that sound shouted by lookouts, Sadollah. It would drift over the air, you Sadollah. And then, sure enough, you would get either a plane go over or an attack from a plane. But we always called it the silver dollar. That's the only way we could understand that Chinese version. Oh, somebody shouting silver dollar. Silver dollar means get your head down, at least. So after this plane had gone, it only lasted about less than a minute. And I thought, I don't believe this. You know, this is a POW camp. I don't believe it. It's the first time we've everybody had woken up. They'd heard the rattle of these guns going off, and the fact that this huge great plane, whether it was a Liberator or whether it, one of the fortress type planes that the Americans used at that time, probably a fortress, I would imagine, ripping away with its tail guns. The tail gunner must have been having a field day. Whatever he was looking at, he must have seen the road running through the village as an MSR, and somebody must have been moving about on it, because he started at the American end of the camp, which was further on than we were. It merged to ours, and then ours merged through and further on up to the barriers across the roads, which were the limits of the camp. You weren't allowed out. And he must have just thought, well, I'll go down low and see if I can catch anybody. He was probably on his way back from north, from north of Yalu, because they used to go up there and bomb the power stations and bridges over the Yalu. And of course he's probably been on his way back and dropped down into the valley for whatever reason. He might even have been hit, because I did see a few heavy bombers come down in the distance over the mountains in flames. They got circled by searchlights, and whether they were hit by anti-aircraft fire or night fighters or SAM missiles or whatever they had at the time, ground-to-air missiles, we did actually see these bombers burst into flames, but very far away, very far away. So we knew they were hitting some industrial site somewhere, and you could see these searchlights shining on the clouds or on the in the night sky over the tops of the mountains. And he might even have done his bomb run and on his way back dropped down low to see if he could pick up anything along the MSR. But I shouldn't have thought they'd bring a bomber that tight into over the top of a valley. It really shook us. Anyway, that was one incident. The next incident was, and I think just after this last incident, the Chinese actually put up a huge wooden platform with a Chinese hieroglyphic on it, some sort of sign in Chinese writing. It was built on a big 20 foot by 20 foot platform on poles at one end of the camp, with painted black with white or blue, white Chinese sign on it. Must have said POW camp or whatever. That was for air identification, because after that, many times the planes used to come over at night, and huge great flashes used to light the sky up. Area photography. So whether the Chinese the Americans were doing it, they were coming over and taking aerial photographs at night of the camp, the POW camp. I mean, they probably did this at all the other camps as well, but they never actually attacked us again. But as I said, the incident that prompted probably quite an outcry at Kaesong was the fact that they came over and actually bombed us, dropped bombs on the camp, a whole stick of bombs from one end to the other, and they killed quite a few Americans. Most of it hit the American end, and I remember there was casualties from the bombing. I don't know how many, if any, British casualties, because things were moving awful fast at that time, and you were more concerned about your own survival than you were about anybody else. Though, as British troops, we sort of stuck together more. You did have to keep your own survival in mind when it came to eating, plotting to escape, which most of us thought was just nigh impossible. And plots were adrift. We plotted many times to see if we could probably make a break for it and try and work our way back. But because of our lack of the of any maps of where we were, any sort of identification of landmarks to tell us in which direction to go. I mean, it's just been as likely for us to have headed north into China or into Mongolia or somewhere as head south towards Pusan. But somebody did make it. I think some Americans, I think, did make it. Who they were, I don't know, but I remember somebody saying some Americans made it, but we really we really gave it up as a bad job. The Chinese themselves told us countless times, if you whisky, you'll be killed. We won't kill you, the local people will kill you. I mean, in the North Koreans, they're all organized into the militias. They had their own militia, they had their own organizations, and if they did catch a prisoner, I would imagine they'd have dispatched him. They were pretty prone to doing that sort of stuff, according to the Chinese. And I think we were far better off being held by the Chinese than being let loose in the countryside or trying to make our way through to civilization, as we called it, back to our own lines. But we're always expecting the Allies, the United Nations troops, to actually liberate us. You believe that? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds are sitting in a camp, and we always expected that the UN would push north, as they had before, right up to the Yalu River, and liberate us. And for the first year, we expected that. We tried to glean any news. The Chinese wouldn't give us a lot. We never knew what was going on from one month to another, but we always waiting to hear gunfire in the distance, like the sound of artillery. When the planes come over and we've seen the battles going on, we thought, great, you know, they must be coming. But they weren't coming. They were still down at the 38th parallel and actually remained there, you know. But we didn't know that at the time. We always expected that we would be liberated, but we never were.
Did you ever hear anything about the Chinese, the allegations of germ warfare?
Oh yeah, that was something the Chinese said, that I think this was during the talks at Kaesong, when they started to tell us, and I noted in my diary, of different things that the Americans had done. Always what the Americans had done, and that the Americans were guilty of dropping dead rats with cholera and different types of diseases, and this and anything that would blacken the Americans' name, or i.e. the UN's name. I mean, we knew that wasn't likely to happen. I don't think, even in the best of brainwashing traditions, that any British soldier, or American for that matter, believed what they were saying. There was allegations of germ warfare. And the way the Chinese put it over to us, if I remember, at the discussion groups, was that they were dropping dead animals containing the Black Death, that cattle anthrax. They were also dropping rats with plague, and also, but it never transpired. Yes, we got sick, and probably might have thought, I wonder if this is the result of what the Americans are doing. It wasn't. It was malnutrition, bad conditions, bad water supply, really bad food. And I attempted earlier to say that I felt that the Chinese eventually tried to feed us and look after us. At first they didn't give you that impression. You were always wondering when you were going to be knocked off, for want of a better word. But gradually you realise that they were trying to keep you alive, because they eventually brought in their own type of doctors, Chinese doctors. Now, these people were probably quite qualified eventually, but they didn't look it to us. Field doctors who visited the camp and done minor surgeries and done minor tooth extractions. It seemed to be the doctors could do anything. The Chinese doctor, he could not only take your teeth out, he could operate on your brain if you needed it, you know. He would extract bullets from those that had bullets. He could take your leg off if you needed an amputation. He was a jack of all trades. We never really, you know, thought, are these doctors or hacks? But they did bring these in, and they did try to improve the food. They brought in during the winter, the first winter, they brought in potatoes. Now, potatoes and Siberian weather do not mix. They go black. They are frozen. And we had sacks upon sacks and upon sacks of potatoes dropped off at the camp by trucks during the night. These are for your food. We, the Chinese, give you food. Potatoes that you like. We do like potatoes. But not black ones. But we tried our best to cook them. And when you cook them, they go into like black water. Black sludge. They dissolve into a black sludge. So we tried every way. We tried boiling them. That didn't work. They just disintegrated into black sludge and like an awful black mess, or grey mess. We tried baking them. They were frozen till you could knock two together like two big pebbles and hear a loud crack when you banged them together, just like you picked up two big rocks from the riverbed and banged them together. The exact noise of a potato that's frozen solid. Crack, crack. And we tried everything to eat them. We tried boiling them, baking them. You couldn't peel them. They were impossible. When you peel them, and break them open, they just split open into two pieces, and they were literally crystallized inside. They were black. Frost ruined them. And the Chinese, I don't know whether they thought they were doing us a favor or something, but we tried to eat them. We boiled them. We needed the stuff anyhow, whatever it was. We didn't turn anything down. You ate it. And we tried cooking it and boiling them, and the blokes who'd done the cookhouse rice cooking, they were the most favoured because they had extras. They tried everything to cook it. Then they started bringing us pieces of pork. Then they brought in whole pigs. They looked like wild boars. They're terrible looking black things. And then one of the Chinese, we used to call him the butcher, the little tiny Chinese, wizened face, must have been about 110 years old, and he was an expert with this huge great knife. He would grab hold of the pig, pull its neck back, and zap, he would zap right under its neck, and blood would fly everywhere. And they used to catch it in a bucket. They used to put them up on a wall or something, and drain the blood out of the pig. They used to take the blood. Then they put them in the big boiling vats till they boiled the pig. He used to blow them up. I'd never seen anything like it. He used to cut on one of the front dew claws of the pig's front leg, and then he would ram a steel rod up. And this little wizened butcher knew exactly what he was doing. He rammed this rod in and out, all the way around the pig, and then he actually put his mouth over the cut and blew the pig up. He loosened the skin up and he blew the pig up till it was all bulged up, and then dipped it in boiling water, scalding hot water in a huge cauldron, and then scraped the fur off it, the black hairs, with a scraper. I'd never seen it done before, but I know that this is what you actually do when you hand kill a pig. You actually steam or boil until you can scrape the hair off. But to blow a pig up like a balloon